Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Midwife's Touch by Sue Harrison, narrated by Candace Fitzgerald. China Deliverance Creed. Part 1. Home. From a mare song. Something you covet deep to the bone. Chapter 1. Taney County. The Southwest Missouri Ozarks, December 23, 1851, as told to me by Mrs. Jessie Settle. Milk Snake Hollow glides lithe as a cottonmouth between Grits Hill and Prophet's Mountain, following the course of Deer Lick Creek. The nearest town of notable size, Springfield, lies north, a gateway to those lands where wealth is more than a cankered wish. Within that hollow, in an old four-square cabin, Yvette Creed writhes upon the bed, delivering her firstborn, a child of prodigious lungs and a tight grip. Yvette's husband, Parnell Hadeus Creed, planned to celebrate the birth with a jug of moonshine, but on that day, whether due to poor planning or lack of moderation, he was down to the last sip in his last jug. When the midwife came from the bedroom, Parnell was sitting in a kitchen chair, a chaw of tobacco tucked inside his lower lip. The midwife was Cherokee, dark as river clay. Folks called her Miss Settle. Her Christian name was Jessie. "Your wife's good, Mr. Creed, and you've got a healthy daughter." A daughter? Shit. Miss Settle washed her hands in the basin atop the dry sink, then turned and fixed him with a hard stare.
"What?"
"Midwives get paid, Mr. Creed."
"You deliver me a daughter and still expect money? And here I am, trying to make a living upon a rock acreage, half of it vertical." "Where you live ain't my problem," said Jessie Settle. "Keeping my body and soul together, that's my prime concern."
Parnell rubbed his forehead.
"How about a chicken? Yvette's got a red-feathered hen. Lays good."
The midwife sat down in the other kitchen chair. "All right, fair deal." Parnell went into the bedroom to see his wife. A small woman, she lay in the center of their bed, her dark curls damp with sweat, her eyes a deep, glimmering black. She tried to smile. "I lived through it."
"You done a lot of hollering."
Her face turned red. "It hurt."
"And for all that, you birthed a girl."
"She's beautiful, Parnell." The baby, wrapped in tight swaddling, was lying in the cradle Parnell had made from green hickory. No mean feat, hickory being an ornery wood hard as iron. Likely to him, all babies looked the same. Maybe that's why he startled when he saw the child for the first time. She had dark eyes like her mother, but her hair shone pale, nearly white. Parnell reached into the cradle and picked her up.
"She's got my hair,"
he said. "She does." He kissed the baby's forehead and swayed back and forth.
"You know, I expected a boy."
"It's not her fault she's a girl."
"True. In a way, she's pretty as a china plate. Never seen a better baby. For a girl, I mean."
Yvette held out her arms. "Give her here, Parnell." He turned his back on his wife and went out to the front room.
"Right pretty, ain't she?"
he said to the midwife.
"She is."
He tucked the baby into the crook of his arm and walked over to the pie safe where they kept their crockery and tins. He took out a small spode plate, blue and white with a gold rim. In the center of that plate was the image of a strange-looking house like none ever known in the state of Missouri. He held up the plate so the midwife could see.
"My wife's prized possession. Belonged to her mother."
He carried the baby and the plate to the bedroom doorway and said to his wife,
"She's prettier than this here plate of yarn, Yvette, don't you think?"
"Parnell," she said, drawing out his name like a plea.
"What do you love most, Yvette, this baby or this plate?"
Her eyes went to the plate first, and he raised his arm as if to dash that spode china against the foot of the bed, but she said, "Why, neither one, Parnell. I love you most. Maybe I don't tell you enough."
"Maybe you don't." He took extra care, though, when he gave her the baby. Yvette turned the child toward her husband. Look here, little one. That's your papa. A brave, strong man who will protect you from anyone with intent to harm.
Hail, Yvette,
said Parnell.
Why do you always think somebody's going to do you harm? This here's Tanny County. We're all good folk.
She gave him a trembling smile and set the baby to suckling. Parnell watched a moment, then said,
Here's her name. China. That's what we'll call her.
Yvette made a face.
I thought you'd like that,
said Parnell. Angèle is a beautiful name.
Your ma's name? I ain't gonna have no daughter of mine named after some fancy French woman. The baby's name is China. I said that, and I meant that. You hear?
She sighed. I hear.
I did want a boy,
Parnell said.
You know, to carry on my name.
He lifted the spode plate, smiled at it. His wife's face took on a look of resignation, her mouth set in a grim line. Parnell dropped the plate. It broke into three pieces.
I'll leave that for you to clean up, Yvette.
He nudged the pieces under the bed with the toe of his boot and left the room, closing the door. He looked at the midwife.
You know what a man wants at a time like this. I don't believe I ever wasted a thought upon that,
she said.
You're uppity for all your Injun blood.
She didn't reply.
A man wants shine. That's what a man wants. Not any old shine, but the pure stuff. Stout as oak, clear as water. Mort Dibbler's shine.
At the dry sink, he batted aside the flour sack that curtained off the storage area. He pulled out three jugs, uncorked each, and lifted them and turned to his mouth.
Empty,
he said. He heaved a giant sigh and dug into the biscuit tin where Yvette kept his money. He opened his palm toward the midwife.
20 cents. All I got to my name. Whatever does my old woman do with all my money? She pay you without me knowing.
Jesse stood up.
She did not. 20 cents won't hardly buy a jug of the worst stuff. But maybe old man Dibbler will give me a deal when I tell him about the baby.
Parnell donned his red wool coat and walked out on the front porch. He left the door open, cold air funneling in, and Jesse saw him stop with a jerk.
What the hell?
He started laughing. Then he shouted,
Come out here, Miss Settle. I need me a witness.
Jesse Settle wasn't a young woman. She wasn't an old woman either, but her legs ached and she was tired. On the other hand, Parnell Creed owned a quick temper. She joined him on the porch where she saw a pyramid of gallon jugs. Parnell was counting aloud, 14 total. He grabbed the top jug, jostled it, and said,
It's full. You brung these? How could I bring them? I've been in this cabin for 12 hours with your wife. You know that.
He uncorked the jug and took a swig.
Dibbler shine.
The sharp yeasty tang rising from the cork brung told her he was right.
You know what, Miss Settle? I'm thinking this is a mean prank. Somebody stacked them jugs on the porch right when Yvette was working hard to push out my baby. They're stole, and I ain't about to hang for something I didn't do. You yourself know I'm an honest man.
She did not deign to agree.
Take them back to Mort. Maybe he'll give you a reward. How am I gonna do that? I don't own no buggy. And if I load them on my mule, he's likely to throw a snit and break them all. Carry over one or two. Tell Mort he can pick up the rest.
Parnell raised the jug in both hands and took another drink.
If that ain't a joyous sup, I don't know what is.
He sat down in the rocker Yvette kept on the porch. That year of 1851, December 23, fell into the new moon time of the month. Night already lay dark as pitch over the hollow. Jesse Settle could not see Parnell's face, but she could tell his next words came to her through a smile.
I got me a pretty wife and a new daughter. I'm a blessed man, Miss Settle. I wish I didn't break that spode plate.
It weren't a necessary thing,
Jesse said.
Parnell snorted but gave no contradicting argument. I'll buy Yvette another one someday, when she gives me a boy.
He drank more shine, then set the jug beside the rocker and picked up two full jugs by their curled handles.
I'm off to the Dibbler place. Tell my wife.
When Miss Settle was satisfied that Yvette and her baby were well recovered, she put the red-feathered chicken in a flour sack, slung it over her shoulder, and took for home. A thin glaze of snow crusted the ground, and it picked up the faint glow of stars. In her right hand, she carried her punch-tin lantern, which cast a fitful light. The hen squawked every now and again, and Jessie tried to allay its fears by crooning a song. She walked about a mile before she came upon Parnell Creed. He'd shed his wool jacket and left it in a heap on the ground. When he saw her, he said,
I worked myself into a sweat. I'll get my coat on the way home.
He set down the jugs.
Them two handles is about to break through my finger bones. Maybe I should drink some off.
If you get drunk,
Jessie told him,
you wind up lost.
Lost? Me? I've been wandering these woods since I were 2 years old.
He already sounded drunk.
Here, you carry one. I got my chicken and I got my doctoring bag and I got my lantern. I ain't carrying no jug of shine. Shouldn't have gave you that chicken.
He made a grab toward the flour sack. Miss Settle sidestepped and he fell. She went on ahead, stopping when she was out of reach.
You all right? Yeah. You need to go back home, Parnell. It's too cold out. I'm your witness that you didn't steal that shine. Just what I need, a red engine for my witness. You think they'd believe either one of us? Maybe not you,
said Jessie. He snarled, got back up on his feet, and took a few running steps toward her. She easily outpaced him. She had no intention of dealing with a drunken Parnell Creed, him being known for his intoxicated violence.
God helps children and fools,
she said to her chicken.
Maybe he helps drunks, too.
That night, she wasted no further thought upon Parnell Creed. Early the next morning, Mort Dibbler, the old man himself, found Parnell lying in a foot of new snow half a mile inside the Dibbler property line. Two jugs of shine sat on the ground next to him, each well sampled. A wide smile was frozen to Parnell's cold, dead face. On January 11, 1852, the Widow Creed dedicated her new daughter to the Lord during the Sunday morning service at the Milk Snake Baptist Church. As per her late husband's request, she christened the girl China, but she added a middle name she deemed appropriate. The congregation's gray-haired widows, 12 strong on a healthy Sunday, agreed that in their long Lord-blessed lives, China Deliverance Creed was the most beautiful baby they'd ever laid their eyes upon. Chapter 2. China Deliverance Creed, age 6 years, 8 months. August 1858.
I'll lie awake on my prickly straw tick. The heat of the day lingers. I got into chiggers that morning, and they left a ring of welts under the waistband of my pantalets. My mare painted their butts with coal oil, her medicine for every malady, and the smell of it in the close, hot space pummels my skull into a fierce ache. During the warm months, if my mare and I aren't camping out in our cave, I keep my straw tick near the attic vent, which lets in an Ozark breeze. One of the vent slats is warped, and the gap gives me a view out. I like to see the fireflies beam their tail lamps in the dark. As I watch, my mare walks into the clearing twixt our cabin and the cowshed. I recognize the woman who comes to her from the woods, and I clamp my hand over my mouth to hold my surprise. Miss Jessie Settle. I've never heard much good about Miss Settle. Maybe because of her dark Indian skin, or maybe because she's rumored to be a Goomer doctor, and thus a woman of odd powers. Goomer doctors are necessary. After all, if some wicked crone throws a spell, you need to have that Goomer in removed. Yet who wants to spend time with an old woman who works in a battleground haunted by hags, haints, and booger dogs? The minute Miss Settle appears, my mare escorts her to the cowshed. A crack in the door lets out the feeble glow from Miss Settle's punch-tin lantern. She and my mare stand there for a goodly long time. When my mother returns to the house, I slide from my straw tick and spy down at her through the gap in the attic door and the stovepipe. She draws a handful of coins from her skirt pocket and dumps them in the biscuit tin, and then, with a great sigh, she goes to bed. The next morning, when my mare is milking her cow, I climb down from the attic and flit around the cabin, battering like a blue-bottled fly, trying to detect any change due to Miss Settle's visit. All seems in order until I open the lid of my mare's sewing box, and there lies a square white cotton bag, no larger than the palm of my hand. I drop the lid like it's poker hot. That Goomer doctor must have paid my mother to sew charm bags. My mare and I don't wear charm bags, although she does believe in the medicinal properties of asafoetida, camphor, and green pennies. I myself hold a great dislike for asafoetida, purely for its stink alone. I'm still standing there by the sewing box when my mare comes in. She's hefting a full milk can, carrying it by the handles, the weight of the thing forcing her into a straddling walk, one foot on either side of it. "Stay out of there, China," she says as she sets down the can. "I saw you last night with Miss Settle, Mama. Are you making charm bags for her?" "It's nobody's business if I do or I don't." She holds up her hands. The knuckles are gnarled with rheumatism, her fingers heading off in peculiar directions from their middle and top joints. "I can't make bobbin lace for Mr. James's store like I used to. I can scarcely tat. I need some way to support us. Miss Settle gets good money for her charm bags, and you know she's a Goomer doctor, which means she's doing the Lord's work, no matter what anyone else might say. And I'm doing the Lord's work when I keep us fed." The held-back weeping sound in her voice scares me. "Teach me to make lace, Mama. Teach me, I'll do it." She smiles, which eases my heart. "I will teach you, but not yet. Your fingers aren't long enough, and neither are your fingernails." I spread my fingers wide. The nails are bitten to the quick. With bobbin lace, you need long fingernails to separate the threads. That evening, we sit out on the front porch, me on the steps and my mare in the rocker. We wave fans of folded newspaper to keep away mosquitoes. I say a silent prayer that God will grow my fingers to help me stop biting my nails. I finish the third repeat of that prayer when my mare begins to sing. She sings in her secret language, words that are ours alone, and I'm not to speak them to anyone except her, nor am I to say my mare or my ma when others might hear. More than once I've asked why. She always says, "Secrets are for keeping." My mare singing, trembling in deep of throat, sends shivers up my arms. When she's done with the hymns, she says, "One last song." And it's ever the same, and I always join in. "Something you covet deep to the bone, but nothing alive with will of its own. Nothing too large, the earth stakes its claim. Nothing unseen, the eyes play the game." Afterward, I fetch a comb and a brush, and my mare starts in on my hair, which flows in cream-colored curls to my waist. Hairbrushing is the only time my mother comes nigh unto touching me. She never holds my hand. She never kisses my face. She seldom gives me a hug. Even if I cut myself or scrape my knees, she keeps a rag between her fingers and my skin. I long for her touch, and in that regard, I live a starving life. In September, my mare sends me to school. I walk the 3-mile trail to town each morning. Each afternoon, I trudge home. I entertain myself during those long walks by whistling and chattering to the birds. I'm good enough that they answer me. Another secret language, but one that even my mare does not speak. The schoolhouse is located at the eastern end of the town of Milksnake. We little ones, first grade through third, are taught in the cloakroom, which is long and narrow with pegs on the walls for coats and caps. Shelves above hold our lunch buckets. A 2-door cabinet stores primers for reading. We youngers have no desks, only benches, and most of us do not own a slate. Our teacher, Miss Otten, speaks with a stutter, which the older children mimic when she's not close enough to hear. Her eyes are brown like her hair and round like her face, but those eyes carry kindness. The only new thing I have for my first year of school is a pair of blue mittens my mare knit with ribbed cuffs that almost reach my elbows. My wool jacket, cut down from an old red barn coat, is stained and faded. But the mitts brighten it nigh unto beautiful. After our first snow, my mare lets me wear 'em to school. Within sight of the schoolhouse, I cross my arms over my chest, the palms of my hands flat against my shoulders to show off my mittens' high-ribbed cuffs. But no one seems to notice. The boys are playing a game with a black leather ball, big around as a baby's head. The girls gather in a huddle near the door. A grade 3 girl stands in the middle. Her name is Mary Preck, but everybody except the teacher calls her Polly. Her yellow hair makes my nearly white braids seem pale and dull. Her blue eyes shine brighter than my brown. My skin, compared to hers, is far too dark from the sun. She owns 3 dresses, plus lace-trimmed pantalettes that peek out from underneath, clean and starched. I push my way up the steps toward Mary Polly, who holds a doll in her arms. Not a rag doll, but a real store-bought waxhead doll. In Mr. James's general store, I've seen dolls for sale, but nothing like Mary Polly's. That doll purses her pink lips into a bud and gazes at the world with perfect blue eyes. Her little feet are shod in black leather shoes with white uppers. She wears a pink coat that buttons up the front and a frothy blue dress underneath. Her yellow hair curls like lamb's fleece. Mary Polly shows us the doll's lace-trimmed drawers and her pink cloth belly. I can't breathe for the want of that doll. When I'm finally able to take my eyes off her, I notice that I've crowded in beside my friend Hazel.
I've never seen a doll like that,
Hazel says. She smiles, and I wonder how she can, since the doll belongs to Mary Polly and not to her. Hazel grabs my hand, and I notice she's not wearing mittens. I take off my left mitt and give it to her. Then we stare at Mary Polly's doll, each of us wearing one mitten with our bare hands clasped for warmth. After school, I let Hazel wear that mitten home with the promise she'll bring it back the next day. Then I make the long trek to our cabin. The smell of new-baked bread greets me while I'm still on the porch. I open the door with a smile on my face. My mare spreads a warm slice with lard, and I eat it as soon as I'm out of my coat. While I eat, my mother pulls the blue mitten from my coat pocket, then searches for the other. Her face turns red.
China Deliverance Creed! Surely you did not already lose one of your new mittens?
Although my mare's accent is barely discernible most of the time, when she's upset, her words take on the cadence of our secret language.
Do you know how much that yarn cost?
No, Mama, I don't know how much the yarn cost. And no, Mama, I didn't lose my mitten. Despite the stern look on her face, I can tell she almost smiles at my answer, despite my sassiness. I lent one of my mittens to Hazel. She don't have none. She doesn't have any. No, ma'am, she don't.
China, that was truly kind of you, but you're my child, and Hazel is not. I must provide for my daughter first. You understand?
Yes, ma'am.
You could have frozen your fingers. Hold your hands over the stove until they're warm.
I do her bidding, although my hands are already warm from that slice of bread. As Mama Air says, arguments are truly won when they're avoided. That night, after our lard, jam, and bread supper, my mother starts knitting a new pair of mittens. For Hazel, she tells me. She crimps her lips, as she always does when the pain of her rheumatism flares, but her 4 needles flash quick as sunfish. She makes the blue-ribbed cuffs first, and then knits the rest of each mitten with stripes of whatever leftover color she has, until I worry that Hazel's mittens might be prettier than mine. By morning, there on the kitchen table lay a pair of striped mittens with bright red thumbs. Now you take these to Hazel, and be sure you get your other mitten back. On the way to school, I put my blue mitt into my pocket and wear Hazel's. When Hazel sees me walking down the iced mud of Milk Snake's Main Street, she comes running, her hands palm to palm in a prayerful fold and stuffed into my other blue mitten.
You got another pair?
No, Ma made them for you. She stands there with her mouth wide open, and finally she says,
Them be the most beautiful mitts in the whole of Milk Snake Holler, China.
I pull my blue mitten from her hands and tuck it under my arm. She puts on the striped ones, As we walk to the schoolhouse, Hazel says, "This is the best day of my whole life. They're only a pair of mitts made of leftover yarn. But they're from you. And looky here." She opens the top button of her ragged jacket. Snugged up against her chest lies a doll like Mary Polly's. The same pink coat, the same curly yellow hair, the same wax face.
"He was in my bed this morning under the quilt. Pa came home last night from working 4 months on the railroads up in New York State. When I showed the doll to Ma, she said he must have brung it. I never thought I'd have such a thing."
I'm on fire with jealousy. But the pure joy in Hazel's face soon converts me to selflessness. She walks halfway up the schoolhouse steps, takes off her striped mittens and hands them to me. Then she slowly pulls that doll from under her coat. She holds it up, face out. Anyone who looks our way can see it. Then I spy Mary Polly walking down the road toward the school. Hazel shouts,
"Polly, look! I got one too. My pa brung it for me."
Mary Polly breaks into a run, her face burning bright red. When she gets to Hazel, she grabs the doll and begins to scream until even the boys stop playing and turn to see what's happening. Hazel opens her mouth, but not one sound comes out, and I realize what Mary Polly is screaming.
"You stole my doll! You stole it! It was gone this morning when I woke up! You stole it!"
The teacher comes outside.
What's wrong?"
She has to ask again before Mary Polly stops yelling.
"She stole my doll, Miss Otten."
"Who stole your doll?"
"Hazel."
"It's mine," Hazel says in a soft, halting voice. "My pa brung it for me."
The teacher looks at Mary Polly, who makes her eyes go wide.
"My doll was gone this morning, Miss Otten. Ask my mother. She's mad as a hornet."
"You believe Hazel's doll belongs to you?"
the teacher asks.
"Yes, ma'am."
Mary Polly tips the doll upside down.
"Look. See?"
She points to three initials embroidered on the petticoat in a pink thread script. MLP.
Mary Luna Prick. My initials.
Hazel's face turns white as if every drop of her blood is drained out. Then she gags and throws up all over the stairway rail.
"See? She stole it,"
says Mary Polly. The teacher gently clasps Hazel's two long braids and holds them back out of the way.
"When did you get the doll, Hazel?"
By then, Hazel is bringing up Yellow Ball, and I answer for her. "She woke up with it in her bed this morning, Miss Otten. She thought her pa brought it. Yesterday, he came home from working 4 months on the railroad." The teacher turns to Mary Polly.
"You can rest assured Hazel did not walk a mile through the woods in the middle of the night to steal your doll."
Mary Polly turns to me and stabs her finger into my cheek. Her nail cuts my skin.
"Then she did it. China Creed took it. She's a thief like her pa was."
I shout into her face. "He was not.
How do you think he died?"
"That is enough," the teacher says.
Mary, take the doll home and leave it there."
I swipe my hand against my cheek and it comes away bloody. But the hurt is nothing compared to Mary Polly's accusation. "My pa was a thief?" Mary Polly turns on her heel and flounces away. The teacher helps Hazel into the schoolhouse. I walk down to the yard and scoop up a riff of snow, press it against my cheek until the bleeding stops. Hazel stays at school the whole day, and when she leaves for home, she puts on the mittens my mother made. But her every breath sounds like a sigh. That evening, I tell my mare what happened. I expect her to jump in on Hazel's side, but she only scurries around the house with a wet dust rag and runs it over every log in the walls, and even stands on a chair to wipe the elbow of the stovepipe. Cleaning like that, it's what she does when she's upset. Finally, she says,
"That Polly Prick is a rude girl, but I think you and I need a new rule."
"What kind of rule?"
"A rule to ensure no one ever thinks you're a thief."
"I ain't a thief, Mama."
"I know, but you need to be careful, China. Don't be touching other people's belongings. Actually, it would be best if you don't touch other people. Touching is rude."
I want to ask about games like London Bridge and Red Rover,
but there's something else I need to bring up.
Polly Prack said my pa was a thief. She said that's why he died.
He was not a thief, China.
Then how did he die?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?